is Zachary B. Wolf, here with Matt Pearson and Kate Caldwell with their book, The Sun Never Sets, a fun steampunk novel. Why don't you give us a little sample of that?
Okay. Well, we were going to start with Chapter 8, because that's when things really get going. Should we just launch into it, or...?
Yeah.
Okay. So, the sky was a patchwork of heavy gray storm clouds and indigo twilight. Once in a while, a star would wink through, as if to reassure Ravi it was still there. The further southwest they flew, the grayer the sky became. Still, they must be over or near an archipelago, because a large bird, some sort of heron or crane, kept pace with them for several minutes. Ravi watched the motion of its wings, both strong and delicate. The wind rippled over its feathers, the same zephyr that went through Ravi's hair. This had been Ravi's lifelong dream, to fly. But now that he was in the air, he found himself pensive. Where was Hiram taking them? And what if the storm hit? The bird does not worry about these things, thought Ravi. The bird is caught up in the joy of flying. Sophia's clothes rustled as she came to stand next to him. She rubbed her arms, her teeth slightly chattering. Ravi slipped off his coat and draped it around her shoulders. You're too much of a gentleman, Ravi. You'll freeze.
I am not bothered by cold, Miss Westbridge, he lied unconvincingly.
Since we've nearly escaped death together, I think you must call me Sophia, she said. She wrapped his coat tight around her shoulders. She sighed heavily then, her breath fogging against the cold.
What's wrong, Sophia?
She seemed surprised that he'd called her by her first name, despite that she had just now asked him to do so. His father. Who will take care of him?
I'm sure he will have the finest doctors in all of India.
But not his daughter to tend to him, she said. All my life I wanted to be free of convention, to travel by dirigible, to have adventures. And now I'm here, flying alongside the birds, and all I can think about is what a terrible daughter I am.
That isn't so, said Ravi.
Oh, but it is. If I hadn't been so curious, I wouldn't have provoked Gunther, and maybe none of this would have happened.
Ravi laughed. Surely you don't mean to take responsibility for the actions of others. You might as soon take responsibility for the storm or the cholera. People know their own minds. The workers who started the fire do, and most certainly Gunther Wolf does.
I may not have started the fire, but I may have fueled it, she said.
Because you are curious? Without curiosity, there would be no airships, no ships of any sort. People would still be concerned with sailing over the edge.
What are you curious about, Ravi?
Where Hiram is taking us.
She smiled. Me too. What else? He looked out at the bird, who now broke off and spiraled downward toward whatever island it had been its destination.
Heavier than air flight, he said.
She cocked her head, bird-like, waiting for him to continue. So he did. He told her about the Crystal Palace and Moy's aerial steamer, and how it had begun his obsession with flying machines. He told her about his proposal to use dirigibles to deliver cargo to the countryside. He told her about his own experiments and how each had failed, but how he had learned something each time.
And now, said Ravi, Hiram insists that he has designed a device capable not only of heavier-than-air flight, but of escaping the Earth's atmosphere. It is as fantastical as the Vimanas in the legends of my people.
Vimanas?
Oh, yes. According to the old tales, the gods and even some of the heroes used flying machines, he said.
My father was supposed to pilot it, you know.
Ravi nodded.
Do you think Hiram will ask us to do it?
He cannot force us, Sophia.
Force us? I'll cajole him in every way I can think of to get into that machine.
Ravi regarded her for a few seconds and then burst into laughter.
Are you amused?
I am certain that is not what a good daughter would do, said Ravi.
Sophia seemed momentarily offended and then grinned broadly. Perhaps not, she said. I will make you a deal, Ravi. If you don't lose your curiosity, I won't lose mine. When Hiram asks you, and you know he will, are you going to agree to pilot the Vimana? Before Ravi could answer, the deck began to shudder, followed by the sound of thumping feet. Hiram charged up like a wheezing rhino.
I need you two layabouts back here, said Hiram.
Why? Is something wrong?
Only that I've been at the helm for 27 hours. Since I don't want to waste any matchsticks by using them to prop my eyelids open, I'll need one of you to fly for a while.
I can pilot the airship?
Pilot? I'll show you how to hold our course so we do not crash into the ocean.
Teach me to pilot the dirigible. I plan to be the best pilot you have ever seen. What do you call this airship of yours, Mr. Coden?
What's that? What do you mean, what do I call it, Hiram huffed.
Its name. I don't see it printed on the hull.
Hiram shook his head. I haven't time to come up with names for every tool and piece of machinery in the factory, Miss Westbridge. I doubt even Mukherjee could have the patience for such a task, or the memory. Go fetch Millicent, I'd say. Which one is Millicent, he'd ask. The mid-sized crank bolt wrench, I'd say. It would all just be confusing and entirely unhelpful.
Charming, Sophia said with a roll of her eyes. I imagine you are a wonderful ballroom companion.
We shall see, should I ever deign to set foot in a ballroom, Hiram replied. Where are we going anyway, demanded Robbie. Rhodesia, by way of Mombasa, said Hiram. Rhodesia, Robbie asked. Are you practicing to become a parrot, my boy? Yes, Rhodesia, a charming place that a most uncharming man named after himself, said Hiram.
We're going to Africa? How exciting, don't you think, Robbie? Robbie shot her a dubious look.
It should be clear sailing from here on, said Hiram. Figuratively, of course.
With that, thunder rumbled through the storm clouds, and the last of the stars disappeared. A heavy raindrop hit Robbie's forehead with a wet slap.
Clear being the figurative part, Robbie asked.
Shortly thereafter, the deluge began. In moments, the three occupants were drenched to the bone. All signs of exhaustion gone, Hiram barked orders.
Take up the slack on the port side.
Robbie raced to the pulley system, Sophia alongside him.
Sophia, tighten that line, yelled Hiram.
She hesitated, then grabbed the rope and pulled.
I'll hold it taut. You knot it, Robbie shouted. She fumbled at first, but after a moment tied a respectable knot.
She's not used to physical labor, thought Robbie, nor is she used to following orders. And yet, here she was, working alongside him without complaint.
There's land a few miles to starboard, shouted Robbie. Shouldn't we wait out the storm? All the way or nothing, Hiram returned, wiping rain from his goggles. Tighten down the aft.
Robbie darted toward the back of the ship. The airship rocked with the driving rain and at one point hailed. The storm pounded them for hours with no signs of stopping. Robbie ran the length of the deck more times than he could count, and he felt every hour of his desk job and his screamingly sore arms and legs. Sophia, however, looked exhausted but also invigorated. Her wild curls ripped around her head like a gorgon, cracks of lightning illuminating her flushed cheeks. Her bicycle suit clung to her legs in an uncomfortable-looking but not unflattering way, and Robbie forced his eyes back to the rigging. He drove himself to move faster, despite his protesting muscles. He would not seem weak in front of Sophia. You care too much, said an inner voice. It was not until the first rays of morning sun backlit the gray horizon that the rainstorm wound down. Everything on the ship was drenched. Deeply exhausted, Robbie was just about to sink to the deck for a much-needed nap when he noticed they were over land and that there were people on it. Relief flooded through him. When he lifted the spyglass, however, the relief was replaced by nausea and more than a little dread.
Mr. Coden, Robbie said to Hiram, who was flapping around his sodden bowler in a futile attempt to dry it off. Yes, yes, what is it? Hiram said irritably. I do not believe those men are British.
Hiram turned from his hat to his equally sodden map. He slapped the compass down on top of it with a grunt.
Oh, bugger it all!
Robbie lifted the eyepiece and peered downward. A man who looked like a soldier peered back through his own spyglass. Robbie shifted the telescope to the soldier's insignia, which was, without a doubt, an Iron Cross. His eyes drifted to the Union Jack on their stabilizing fins.
Are we in German territory? Robbie asked. No, said Hiram.
Robbie was about to protest when Hiram said,
We're over German territory.
One of the soldiers raised a rifle.
I don't mean to alarm you, he said, but the Germans are pointing guns at us. I wouldn't worry about that, said Hiram. We're much too high for them to shoot accurately, even if they were so inclined.
Three rifle shots rang out in the distance, followed by a hiss from above. Robbie leaned back to look at one of the gas bladders now leaking.
Though we are very large, said Hiram.
The Germans unleashed another volley of shots, which resulted in another leak.
Stop trying to reassure me. Every time you do, the universe conspires to make things worse, shouted Robbie.
Sophia ran up, panting. We're being shot at, she yelled.
We know, Hiram and Robbie yelled in unison.
Robbie glared at Hiram, who raised an eyebrow and glared right back.
For a brilliant man, you can be quite inept, Mr. Coden, said Robbie. And for a civil servant, you can be quite unhelpful, Hiram retorted. Now tighten the cargo lines. I don't want the equipment damaged. What does it matter, spat Robbie? The Germans will dismantle. The Germans will not be a problem when we land, said Hiram. We're going to crash, yelled Robbie. Yes, In British East Africa, Hiram said triumphantly, enunciating each word. Forgive me if I do not take much comfort in your imaginary line as we plummet to our deaths, shouted Ravi. You really need to relax, Mukherjee, and we need that machine.
Ravi flinched as Hiram let loose a mighty bellow. His legs were braced and his mouth frozen at a grimace as he pulled back on the gears. Hiram and the gears groaned in unison, as if they were part of the same organism, some flying mechanical pachyderm. Ravi and Sophia lurched as the ship grazed the ground and then lifted back up.
Hold on to your hats, Hiram shrieked.
Ravi tentatively put his arm around Sophia.
Don't worry, Sophia. Everything is going to be all right, he said.
Hearing the tremor in his own voice, his heart sank at how not comforting his words were. Sophia laughed out loud. Please don't die, Ravi, she said. You are far too magnificent. The airship touched ground again, this time skidding across the ground, throwing clumps of dirt, rock, and sagebrush. Ravi pulled Sophia to him, guarding her head with one arm and his own with the other. He peered through his fingers. A tree was barreling at them at the speed of an angry bull elephant. Ravi braced himself as they hit, the impact reverberating through the deck, which fell away beneath them. Suddenly airborne, Ravi closed his eyes, Sophia's head still tucked to his chest. His shoulder thudded against the ground, and he skidded several feet to an abrupt halt. Ravi blinked, then patted himself down, surprised to be alive. He then turned to Sophia, who was wide-eyed, her shoulders shaking with hysterical laughter. He grinned, momentarily grateful even for the burning pain in his shoulder, which verified his aliveness. Hiram grinned wide.
Ha, he said, throwing his fist in the air. Mukherjee, come help me assess the damage done by the bloody Huns.
Hiram immediately scurried to the rocket, gingerly examining it. After only a moment, Hiram wheeled, eyes wider than Ravi had ever seen. He turned several shades of red, then white, then slightly green.
Of all the... those bloody...
Then words failed him, and he let out a frustrated bellow.
Are you quite all right, Mr. Coden? Ravi asked. No, Mukherjee, I am not.
Hiram pulled out an aluminum ball, about the size of a human head. The bullet had pierced it, leaving it bent and inoperable.
The gyroscope, Ravi asked tentatively.
Hiram groaned by way of response. Ravi remembered that this was a replacement part, that it had only been recently completed, and that it was the last piece of equipment required to launch. He also knew that it had taken quite a long time to fabricate. Hiram hurled the gyroscope at a nearby acacia tree, scattering a flock of birds. Neither Ravi nor Sophia wanted to break the awkward silence. Finally, Hiram's power of speech was restored.
Well then, I'll just have to convince Cecil to build us an aluminum foundry and hire machinists so we can fashion another.
Ravi and Sophia exchanged doubtful glances. She winced.
I hope you both have comfortable shoes. We have a walk ahead.
Ravi's shoulders sagged.
All right, for those of us who aren't as familiar, can you give us an introduction to these characters that are in such peril?
Yeah, we probably should have done that from the get-go. Our brief summary of this is First Man in Space, 1899. Hiram Coden has built a spacecraft and is ready to launch it, but he keeps losing pilots. Like, the first one up and quit. The second one was Sophia's father, who had a bad mishap and his arm melted off. And then his rival scientist, who wants to steal the spacecraft, has now blown up a factory, which is where they're fleeing from. And he is after it to steal it. And he also had stolen another of the gyroscopes, and they've got to get that back. So Ravi is essentially a bureaucrat. He works for the Indian Civil Service. And he had lost his job for other reasons. And Hiram recruits him to manage the place. And then he ends up being kind of drawn in and ends up, you know, being a pilot. And he's got an engineering background and, you know, kind of helps him with the whole thing. But originally, he's a bean counter. He's supposed to be just a manager. So.
Completely out of his element.
Can you tell us a bit about your process?
Well, Matt actually came up with the original concept. He wrote the original short story, and it was very short. How long was it?
A couple thousand
words.
Yeah, 3,000, maybe 4.
Yeah.
Very short.
And I had read it, and I'm like, oh, this is really interesting. We maybe should write a screenplay, because we were writing screenplays at the time. And so we sat down and we kind of like plotted it out scene by scene and then decided who would write what scene. And then we went away and wrote our scenes and then came back and put it together and then passed it back and forth and changed each other's stuff until we had a finished script. And then we shot that around for a while in LA, and the people in LA, the producers, they were producers with less money than the big studios. And they were all like, I love the concept, I don't have the money for that, sorry, but no. And so we thought, well, if budget's really the problem, maybe we can try doing a novel. And then Matt wrote the first scene, but I think I did do most of the adaptation, the first draft of the adaptation of this, but then we passed it back and forth again.
Okay.
And it mutated through, what, 16
variations?
And just during the reading, I caught a typo that everybody missed, so.
I guess no matter
however many eyes have been on it, it's like.
Yeah. Wow, so that went through 17 or so drafts before it even got to us?
Yep.
I think so. Yeah, there was the, I don't know how many drafts of, I think the screenplay version was 16 drafts.
Yeah.
And then when we adapted it, it was
about 5, 6.
Yeah. Because I do remember some of those early screenplay drafts where we just adapted the thing. It was like, yeah, this is missing something. I don't know. It needs more of an Indiana Jones sort of thing. How do you get that? Had Nazis. Well,
they're
we can't have Nazis.
It's,
you know,
it's
well, yeah,
Nazis.
But we can have Imperial Germans.
Fighting for the Kaiser.
So how long was that in the works?
When was your first?
Well, I don't remember when the short story was done, but it just kind of sat around for a couple of years.
Well, but then we did the screenplay, and I know that we had that done in 2011, because it was a finalist in the Page Award screenplay competition. In 2011.
Wow. I think it was, 2011 sounds about right.
Yeah.
So are there pieces of yourselves in these characters, or?
Well, always, sure. I mean, nothing is specifically autobiographical, obviously, but.
Right, you didn't buy the rituals in space in 1900.
Yeah, writing for Hiram was very easy.
Oh, well, there you go. Matt, you did all of the illustrations for this, so you did the cover design. It's a fantastic cover. Can you tell us a little bit about your inspiration, your thought process through this?
I think like writing the story itself, it was put together a cover concept. I don't like it. Put together another cover concept. I don't like it either. 4 or 5 in, I kind of like it. Kate doesn't like it. And then finally we got to this one.
So how many drafts did the cover go through?
6 or 7, I think. I probably still have them all saved away in a folder someplace in very rough form.
Sure.
And
there's a couple of points in here through the book, there's illustrations as well.
A handful of illustrations of the machinery that are supposedly taken from Hiram's own sketchbook.
It really adds depth to the whole thing, kind of brings you into, it feels like I'm in this whole world.
And it also saves us having to spend 3 pages doing a Tom Clancy-style explanation of exactly how something works.
Right.
We did run into a little bit of that in Hollywood. In fact, there was one producer whose big objection to it was, well, that's impossible. It's like, well, first off, I'm pitching you a movie script. Second, I mean, this is based on Soviet rocketry. So it's like if you had really, really good machining and you pushed everything right to the limit, you could build this with the technology of the time with about a 50% chance that you wouldn't die. So
it stretches the limits of plausibility. But
yes.
It's at least as plausible as the Transformers. Or
I was caught a little off guard by that. Oh, well, that's impossible. Where am I?
I think the closer you get to plausibility, the more of that you get. Like, nobody looks at Harry Potter and says, that's impossible.
Right. This is outrageous. Is there a particular theme that you, as the authors, would say overarches the story?
A theme? I don't know. I think everything that I write has a little bit of this disdain for authority that kind of creeps in. It's like, even if I'm not doing it intentionally, it just kind of oozes in there through the cracks.
And I think there's a lot of discussion, too, about, like, science being a neutral force. because there are characters that want to use science for good, like Ravi, and those that want to use it for destruction, like Gunter Wolf, and then Hiram, who's just curious. And he doesn't really think too much about how his inventions are going to be used. He just wants to see if they can work, you know. And it's just this kind of discussion about, it's really about people. All science does is kind of like push forward what's already happening with the people.
All right. Yeah, we can open up the floor to questions.
Hi.
Hi.
I recall we met you. I met you in the elevator.
Yes.
What year does this take place? You said
1899.
1899. Not exactly Soviet era.
No.
Not exactly. Nazi era.
No, but kind of borrow forward a little bit.
Okay. What prompted you to set your story in 1899, given England's preeminence in the world, its industrialization of the world, its inventiveness, its innovation, its patent proliferation? What prompted you to go there?
Well, when I initially wrote the short story, the concept was kind of thinking about all of those things and what was going on, the innovations at the time, and thinking, would it have been possible for somebody, if they had essentially unlimited funding, could they have put a man in orbit with the technological capability of the time?
With the dirigible.
Well, wasn't even getting that far at the time when I was originally playing with the concept. It was like, okay, looking at some of the very early Soviet rocket systems where they're using kerosene basically as your propellant. Things, you know, you very simple stuff that was available at the time, and thinking, okay, could you push this late 19th century stuff to that level where it's just on the edge of going to work? And wrote the story kind of based on that, and then it's like the characterization and everything sort of followed from it, but that was sort of the seed that we were building on, and it was afterwards where it was like, well, we could, you know, save some fuel and put the thing on the dirigible and get that up as high as you can and save some altitude that way, and working out some of the technical stuff, which was mostly the deal that I was dealing with, and then Kate was working on, you know, characters and plot and all this
nonsense
stuff.
Was it, you started with the question, like, if you had the engineering knowledge, what's the earliest with the materials of the time you could actually put something in orbit?
Yeah.
And came up with, if you went back in time, and you had the knowledge, but you didn't have any modern materials, with the materials of the time, what's the earliest you could?
How much knowledge are you implying, suggesting? Knowledge of the day with the materials of the day? Or are you taking knowledge from today? And
well, no,
it's
very much taking, like, extrapolating from what was known at the time as far as you can. And it's like one of those things that you don't really have to have the full scientific understanding of the phenomenon that's going on to start working on the engineering. You just have to be able to kind of push things ahead. It's sort of like, I'm trying to think of a good example. The one I always fall back on is some of the nuclear stuff, where when they were working on that in the 40s, they were really kind of pushing that forward without necessarily having the full grasp of everything that's going on. And this is kind of like an earlier version of that, where it's like, okay, you know that if you combine these things and you ignite them, they'll explode, and you can control that explosion, invent it out a certain way, and you know that the Earth is this round thing exerting a gravitational force, and if you have enough thrust, you can get away from it. And just, he's kind of going from there and working, like, how do we exploit this? And it's,
well, like, people could still navigate ships when they thought the Earth was flat.
Yeah. Well, that's a great example. Yeah, the Ptolemaic navigation, where it's like, it works well enough. And then that Hiram just gets to that point of realizing that, well, if you take a ball and you seal it up full of air and you put a guy in there and you fling it hard enough. And then, yeah, he's just got to work out the details of how to make that happen.
Getting him back, not necessarily important.
You fling him hard enough, but not so hard that he just...
So will you try and pitch this again, or is that out of the picture? Is this too
I wouldn't
much
rule
effort?
It out,
okay.
But it's not on the immediate slate of things that we're going to be trying to do, because we've both got two or three books that we're working on.
Well, that was my next
we've got to get all these things done.
In the same genre or something different?
Fantasy related, not historical fantasy necessarily, but I've been working more on like epic fantasy kind of. And yours is science fiction.
Yeah, mine's straight up hard sci-fi. And I've had a couple people that have asked about whether there's a sequel to this in the works, and I'm like, well, I'm not going to rule it out, but we're not working on it right now.
So the projects that you're working on right now are separate? Are you doing any collaborative, or is everything kind of collaborative?
To some degree. There's a lot of, we'll work on something all morning and then over lunch sort of debrief each other on what we did.
Yeah, well.
Get some comments back and forth that way.
We're each other's first read, usually. Like, when I finish a book of my own, he's the first person that reads it, because he gives really good notes. And it doesn't matter that I'm his wife. If something's not working, he'll be like, you know what, this does not work. Yeah, and so I'll take it back and rewrite it, which is good, you know, and vice versa.
Yes, she definitely does that back.
Well, it can't just go one way.
Now, do you guys follow microtrends in the business? You know, what do you guys read the Variety or Hollywood Reporter and kind of
occasionally?
See, can you decipher all that trending and the?
I try not to think about it.
Schools of thought on that, following the trades and the tracking boards and everything. The one was you have to be aware of what's selling, and the other one is don't let it play too big of a role, because by the time you're done and you're ready to sell it, that thing might not be selling anymore anyway, so write what's in you.
Sure,
you know,
it could be
so.
A year later by the time they start rolling tape.
All right, thanks, Matt, Kate. It's been lovely. That's The Sun Never Sets, available now on greenwolfpublishing.com.